welcome back to one of the final episodes of the first series of the Wall Podcast. I cannot believe that we are nearly finished series one, and I'm already excited to get started on series two. As you can probably tell by the title of this episode, it's an interview with Gillian O'Shea Brown. She's a licensed clinical psychotherapist, advanced EMDR practitioner, and complex trauma specialist. Originally from Cork, she now owns a psychotherapy practice in Manhattan's Flatiron District. She incorporates integrative healing techniques such as EMDR, cognitive behavioral therapy, and somatic psychotherapy, and more. You'll understand a little more about these once you finish this episode. Gillian sat down with me to share her understanding of trauma itself, the big T trauma and the small T relational trauma. Specifically, she explains how and why these experiences have an effect on our well-being and overall quality of life. She explains how our mind is wired to cope when immersed in various distressing experiences, and how, with the help of the right therapy, we have the ability to treat and manage ourselves. This episode is relevant to us all, but especially those who are curious about how the mind copes with trauma or just unwanted life experiences in general. Gillian explains what you can expect from therapy, her various therapeutic approaches, and how they work. I learned so much from this episode, and I really think that you will too. If you want to contact Gillian directly, you can email her or check out her website, and I'll leave both in the description box below. Thank you so much again for tuning into this episode and for supporting series one. Enjoy, and I will talk to you on the next one. Gillian, you are another Irish girl that I've met for the first time that's killing it in New York. I know we've been chatting here about how we got here and the fact that we've never met each other before despite being in the same age group, which is really great to see and really refreshing. For people who might not have heard of you, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, first off, I want to thank you for having me. I think you're doing really wonderful work by creating a conversation around mental health in Ireland. And I hope that you're shining a light for people.
Yeah.
I own a psychotherapy practice across from the Flatiron building here in Manhattan. I am an EMDR practitioner. I see couples and individuals, and I also serve as a trauma affiliate at the Integrative Trauma Program at the National Institute of Psychotherapies. And I'm just very appreciative to have this opportunity. And I am actually a big fan of your podcast, so I hope that you continue this good work.
When I came in, you told me you'd listen to every episode. I was like, yes, I like this woman.
I have to do my homework.
Yes, I appreciate that. And I appreciate the time, someone like you who's doing work to help people in their daily lives become, you know, to heal themselves and to have those kind of skills to get through life, or, you know, all those natural things that life does throw at us. So I really admire that in a person. And of course, that's why I wanted to have you on, because I feel like it's of benefit to people. And we talked a little bit earlier about trauma. The word trauma is almost kind of traumatic to hear. You kind of say, oh, you know, it's a rough word, it's a hard word. From my perspective as a therapist, you might not feel the same, but as a therapist that specializes in trauma, can you talk to me about how trauma, that word trauma, may be thrown around a little bit? Maybe people don't have the same idea as they show, as your understanding of it, and what kind of quantifies as trauma, really?
So you're absolutely right in what you're saying. It is a bit of a trigger word, and it has a lot of negative connotations. Mm. When people think of trauma, they think of big T trauma.
Yeah.
Like you're living your life and it's safe, predictable, reliable, and then out of the blue something happens that shatters your world.
Mm.
And, you know, that is a big T trauma.
Yeah.
But often trauma is not big T. Often it's small T traumas. And I'll give you an example, and, you know, I'll play to your audience here. Let's say, for example, you have a very hardworking, ambitious young girl mm-hmm. who's beginning to have panic attacks.
Yeah.
And she's having, you know, racing cyclical thoughts, heart palpitations, maybe pains in the stomach. You know, the hormones adrenaline and cortisol are coursing through the body. And the way that trauma work would actually come into play in that scenario is you would be very open and curious about the internal dialogue in her mind. And often the internal dialogue, when you really gently peel back the layers and become very open and curious, it can reveal a negative schema or a negative self-belief.
Mm-hmm.
And that negative self-belief might be, I'm not good enough, I'm not lovable, I'm a bad person. And if you track that back, what I actually like to do with my clients that mm-hmm. come here for therapy is I will write the negative schema on a piece of paper and draw a timeline. And I will have them identify 3 to 5 times in their life when they felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
And what we actually have then is targets. And when you go back to the original event or the time when they were made to feel not good enough,
yeah.
bad, unlovable, that is actually a traumatic event. And it's often, you know, death by a thousand cuts.
Mm.
It may not be a big T trauma, but it might be very reoccurrent, and that negative self-belief is reinforced.
Mm-hmm. So what are the main differences in the way that the human reacts to big T? Maybe there isn't any differences, but the big T trauma and then the, you know, the death by 100 cuts. What is the different ways is when somebody comes in terms of symptoms or their way of explaining things, can you identify, you know, and I'm sure there's a lot of people who associate, they kind of blame it on one trauma, but there could be other little traumas in the back that have kind of accumulated. So how do you tear away at what's really going on?
Well, you've asked me a lot of questions, so yeah. I'm going to work my way through them and do my very best. I love your optimism. So first off, we all have a negativity bias.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on the age of your viewers or your listeners, rather, mm-hmm. You'll remember where you were when you heard about 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how beautiful your outfit was last Tuesday, you probably won't remember it.
Yeah, and that's something my mom has said to me before. I think you're referring to is that we're humanly wired to
yes.
think negatively or
yeah.
hold on to negative thoughts more.
When you are put in a place of fight or flight
mm-hmm.
and your body is coursing with adrenaline and cortisol, the stress hormones, and your brain takes a snapshot, your amygdala takes a snapshot, I'm going to keep the jargon light, and everything that looks like, feels like, or seems like that original event is programmed into your brain to be an indicator that you may not be safe.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that the brain works is that your memories are connected like links of a chain,
yeah.
connected by negative beliefs. And you may have several negative beliefs, or you may just have one really strong recurrent one. So anything that looks like, feels like, or seems like the original trauma can evoke the same physiological response. And sometimes, you know, people are not in a place of fight or flight, they're in a place of freeze. And that might have a somatic, the response has also a somatic symptom. And somatic is the relationship between your mind and your body.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, tightness in the throat,
mm-hmm.
it might be the words that you never got to say or the tears that you won't allow yourself to cry.
Mm-hmm.
So every time that you're made to feel quote unquote, let's say unsafe,
mm-hmm.
it might be, oh, I don't know why, but I'm having this tightness in my throat. Or for example, another person, it might be tightness or pain radiating off the back of the head, like a stress headache. Or it might be tightness and pain in the shoulders because you feel belittled by your company and you're making yourself smaller. And the body will remember and respond in the same way as the original mm-hmm. trauma. And sometimes your mind is not registering that your body is responding to something because it's reminiscent of something painful that occurred at an earlier time.
Okay, and how does that happen? Is that too deep of a question? How does the body speed up faster than the mind in that sense for a reaction?
Well, the body and the mind can work in very different ways.
Okay.
What sometimes happens with trauma is that the memory is fragmented. The clinical term is disassociation,
mm-hmm.
but I like to call it the fog. And sometimes when people have a traumatic event in their lives, they only remember fragments of the memory.
Mm-hmm.
And we can actually work with those pieces in terms of trauma work. But as a coping strategy, the brain will sometimes it's too painful to be 100% present.
Mm-hmm.
So then the disassociation or the fog can creep in, and that's a subconscious defense mechanism.
Is that, and I know I'm digging quite deep here, when somebody passes away that's close to us, those initial days, is that what you're referring to as well? It's almost like a dissociation with that grief?
Not for everyone, but bereavement is such an intensely painful and individualistic experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there's often a sense of disbelief, or it might take weeks or months to register that this person is actually gone.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in Ireland, the first couple of, you know, weeks or months, you're entertaining, you're responding to people, and you're trying to facilitate other people's pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it might take a while for you to actually access your own pain after the storm has passed.
Yeah.
So, you know, bereavement is an enigma in that way, because it's such a individualized experience.
Yeah. Okay. So when you talk about trauma and the body's response and the brain's response, for individual people, are we looking at different levels? What makes somebody, or is somebody more predisposed to trauma based on them as a person, or are we all just wired in the same way to deal with things? You know, what makes somebody more sensitive to trauma?
So that is a really wonderful question. And to fully answer your question, I have to refer to a piece of research that was done,
okay.
researching PTSD.
Okay.
And that was the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. And it was initially piloted as, you know, a very short questionnaire, just 10 questions. And the questionnaire would ask things like, did you grow up in a home where you felt like people didn't care about each other? Or did mm-hmm. you ever feel like you were going to be hit? Did you feel like, well, actually housing is a blind spot on it, but did you feel like you were shouted at or demeaned in a public way?
Mm.
And this 10 question questionnaire, this short questionnaire could actually predict the likelihood of developing PTSD later on.
Okay.
And PTSD gets a really bad rep, because people think about people, you know, coming home from serving in the military, or people experiencing, you know, a lot of flashbacks and intrusive thoughts. But it's really more of a continuum or a spectrum. And, you know, trauma can be, you know, it can be a very intense fearful experience,
mm-hmm.
or it can be this, you know, sneaking, you know, negative schema that arised at an earlier time.
Yeah.
And Bessel van der Kolk piloted, you know, he basically asked for complex PTSD to be put in the diagnostic symptom manual. And that is more the, you know, the layered compounded trauma,
mm-hmm.
maybe from early relationships. And then, you know, PTSD itself can be referred to more from, you know, very intense, you know, big T or small T events.
Okay. Yeah. Are we all carrying a little bit of trauma?
This is going to be incredibly biased. Because I have the tools to treat trauma, I do somatic experiencing, Hakume.
Mm-hmm.
I do EMDR, that's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also do some ego state work, known as internal family systems model.
Okay.
And
I
gently weave them in,
okay.
According to the client's needs. And when applicable, you know, if a client is looping, or if there's a blockage
mm-hmm.
in their processing,
mm-hmm.
or they have something, you know, very, very painful going on, I'll use those tools. And
okay.
I may not necessarily label it as trauma for them, But I'll say to them, you know, that memory has a charge.
Okay.
Or it's very painful for you to access that. Would you be open to me making you feel more comfortable? So a roundabout way, a very long way of answering your question is yes.
Yeah.
But I don't want to pathologize, you know, the painful memories that people carry.
Yeah. So when you say blockage, do you just mean a memory that they are finding difficult to connect with?
Yes. It can also be, Stan Takin would call this the bite that fits the wound. And
okay.
That's when you have an early pain in your life.
Yeah.
And let's just say, I'm going to give a really, going to pick an example from my mind here. Let's say you didn't get picked for a school play.
Mm-hmm.
And
we all been there?
And you begin to say to yourself, well, you know, I'm not good enough.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good enough. So why?
Yeah.
And then years later, something else occurs and you tell yourself again, I'm not good enough. And you create this emotional map of the world. And every time that you're made to feel not good enough in a relationship, at work, at different points in your life, you have this really visceral, powerful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say as an adult, let's say, you know, you're out in the world, you're doing your thing. And you have a professional experience that activates this old wound, the bite
mm-hmm.
that fits the wound, that makes you feel not good enough. But you kind of think, wow, my response is disproportionate to the stimuli, and I don't know why. And even to talk about it might be very painful.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you don't talk about it. Maybe you just get panic attacks every
mm-hmm.
time you're self-doubting or you have these self-limiting beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, you know, there's a little bit of trauma for many people, and there's blockages, and that sometimes it's really hard to find the words, and just retelling your pain over and over again isn't enough.
Mm.
You need to go a little bit more deeper and strategic in the work.
Mm. To connect the link backs as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so for people who might be listening, and don't worry if you repeat yourself on this question because it might be necessary, but I suppose if people are listening, they might have clicked into this because they have experienced the big T trauma, or
yeah.
they might just be interested in how, you know, the mind works. When you get somebody in, and what is your approach to treating them, and what could they expect from, you know, therapy? Not necessarily saying you, but how would, you know, a general approach, how would you approach it generally, therapy, and what would that look like? I suppose the reason that I'm asking is kind of to conquer the little bit of fear that they might have from taking the plunge, and kind of, you know, move away from that stigma that we have with therapy. So I would hope that what you say would make them feel more comfortable.
Yeah. So I do work with individuals and couples.
Mm-hmm.
I see everyone, though there is a focus on trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of my clients have trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So every client is very unique.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a particular toolbox, but I use a personalized blend for each client.
Okay.
So in the beginning, when you're getting to know someone,
mm-hmm.
The first session, people will come in and, you know, you're really trying to get to know them as much
yeah.
as possible. And one thing that I'm really, really interested in is, you know, especially from, let's say, 0 to 5, 0 to 8, you create an emotional map of the world in terms of who you are, who you should trust, and how you should survive.
Yeah.
And then the personality kind of solidifies or begins to solidify as much as it can in adolescence.
Yeah.
And I'm very interested in just learning about someone's emotional map,
mm.
how they see themselves. And how do they want to see themselves?
From 0 to 5, or just as they are?
Zero
to eight.
As they are, but those early years,
mm-hmm.
I try to get some history, and sometimes people will come in and say, I do not want to revisit those years,
mm-hmm.
or I have very little memory.
I don't, yeah, and you just saying it now, I have no idea, no memory at all. I mean, that's a bad thing.
No, not at all. But what I'm very interested in is
yeah.
Presenting issues.
Mm.
You know, what brings you in today?
Mm-hmm.
And then I learn a little bit about mental health history. If there's
mm-hmm.
been therapy in the past, if there's been any medications or any significant life events.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in knowing about substance use, just mm-hmm. as a kind of general background. I'm also interested in knowing about their other medical health. And I also like to kind of find out about a person's sleeping, their appetite, their libido, their level of stress at the moment, a little bit about their social network in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, the people that mean the most to them, how supported they feel. And I always, always like to find out about, you know, how do they want therapy to serve them?
Mm-hmm.
What is the vision that they have for themselves? And how will they know therapy's working?
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes people will come in and they'll say, you know, I don't want to feel, I want to stop feeling stress, I want to stop having anxiety. And it's very hard to serve someone who mm-hmm. just doesn't want to feel.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of comb through that together and we yeah. kind of, you know, I want to process the pain behind the anxiety, or I want to develop coping strategies
mm-hmm.
To reduce my cognitive hyperarousal, which is like that racing thoughts, that physiological response that you feel when you're frightened or mm-hmm. anxious or nervous. And you get very specific in terms of those goals.
Yeah.
And what I like about doing that is I believe in the concept of synergy. And synergy is when you look at one area of your life, you see all areas of your life. So if the client can begin to ask for what they want, advocate for themselves, be very open in the therapy room, I hope that they can bring that with them in all other areas
mm-hmm.
and begin to make that part of, you know, their emerging internal knowing self.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of synergistic approach. I was interested when you said you kind of delve into the sleep, the substance use, friend network. Does that all play a role? Like how do you handle their feedback on that, or what kind of signs would you be looking for?
So I'm very, very interested in sleep. You know, all of the research on adults is that we should really be getting 7 to 9 hours.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a third of your life.
Mm.
And it has a massive impact in terms of your mood and your general sense of well-being.
Mm.
And in terms of sleep disturbance or night terrors or, you know, levels of stress,
mm-hmm.
it can be very, very telling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no matter how much good therapy you do with someone,
mm.
if they can't sleep because their living conditions are unsuitable or there's noise pollution mm. or their partner has sleep apnea and it's impossible to sleep.
Yeah, automatically is that having an impact on pretty much everything else that's going on?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. It's going to compound all of the stress and their coping abilities.
Okay.
Libido and interest in pleasurable things, it's very important too. It can be diagnostic in terms of considering body issues and also depression.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of relationships, it's very important to know, you know, what is going on in someone's life and if someone is ready to talk about that. And obviously you can go into a therapy session and be asked probing questions and say, today I had an intention that I was going to talk about my boss who is bullying me
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to talk about my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of steer the ship. You can mm-hmm. you can really advocate for yourself
mm-hmm.
and get the most out of therapy by being discerning mm-hmm. and advocating for yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. So what else is in your toolbox in terms of treatment past the kind of first stages and getting to know somebody?
So I'm very, very interested in, and this might get a little bit heavy,
mm-hmm.
The internal family systems model,
okay,
which is about ego states, and that's inner child work.
Okay.
So, you know, it basically is all of the different parts of you that vie for airtime, the courageous part of you, the anxious part of you, and the part of you that believes that you're possible of great things
mm-hmm.
and the part of you that questions all of your risky decisions.
Okay.
And I do some experiential work through somatic experiencing and meditation in terms of forging a more integrative sense of self.
Okay. So what, can you break that up a little bit for me? I'm trying to stay with you. When you say airtime for those self-confidence and self-doubt, yeah, what yeah. do you mean by that in relation to the childhood?
So basically, there are times when you're having an internal conflict.
Yeah.
Let's go with you for an example. Let's
okay.
say you're about to move to America.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a part of you that's kind of very curious, very playful, kind of thinking, what could be ahead of me? This
mm-hmm.
could be wonderful. But then there's another pragmatic part of you that's very anxious and fearful, saying, hey, you know, stay with your government pensionable job. What
mm-hmm.
are you doing? And then there's another part of you that's absolutely astonished that you've gotten this far in the first place.
Yeah.
And what can happen with big life decisions is that you can have an internal conflict and kind of like different parts of you vying for airtime. It can be really hard to make solid decisions from a place of being strategic and
yeah.
methodical and pragmatic if you feel like you have a lot of internal conflict. So it's really about self-awareness. It's about deepening the understanding of yourself.
Okay.
So that all parts can play a role in terms of your decision making.
Yeah.
And everyone has parts of self.
Yeah.
It's just when you begin to be mindful of them, it can be a tool that you can use where you can explore converging emotions or challenging decisions that lie ahead of you.
Okay. So you're saying which gets more airtime, that you might have, like if you're at a crossroads, that you might have a point where you feel discouraged or you feel self-doubt, or you feel playful and curious. And the ones that we act on are the ones that get more airtime.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, especially clients that come in with generalized anxiety, the fearful part has been hogging the microphone,
the limelight, okay,
and they've been drowning out all of the other parts.
Mm-hmm. So you would say, you know, hey, you know, what did you feel at that point or with this decision or this situation, what was going on in your head? And they might say, well, you know, a part of me thought I could do it, but I was too scared, or
yeah.
you know, my mom or my dad said, or so and so said that I couldn't do it, and so that is too strong. You know, and that's kind of, they're acting on the stronger emotions or
absolutely
beliefs.
And it can become more manageable then in their internal dialogue if
mm-hmm.
they say, I want the fearful part to step aside
mm-hmm.
just so I can hear from the other parts of me. And often the voice of the internal dialogue is the voice of the dominant parent.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a very worried, conscientious parent that wants to keep you safe and wants to care for you, you might hear their cautious voice in your head and you might be preempting that as being very fearful and risk adverse.
Mm-hmm.
But your intuition or your internal guiding voice might be telling you, go for that job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put yourself out there, ask for what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So the parts type worker, you know, internal family systems, ego therapy, it creates a model and it creates a language for clients to begin to access, you know, their own inner strength that is always within them. Because
mm-hmm.
ultimately with therapy, what you want is you want to give your client the tools so that they can face life's challenges
mm.
and be empowered and take everything that they've learned, maybe share it with someone they know
mm-hmm.
or take it with them so that they can do everything that they have envisioned for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I take it very seriously when I take on a client. And if they have a blockage or, you know, a very challenging issue with their mental health, I'll go and I'll really try to find the answer and do more training in that area
mm-hmm.
To serve them, because I have a duty of care over them. But
mm-hmm.
obviously if it's beyond my realm of practice, I'll
mm-hmm.
refer to a specialist. But I'm not just taking the walk with them. I am with them to fulfill the intentions that they have set in terms of how they want therapy to serve them.
Yeah, exactly. When you talk about the, is it internal family systems?
Yes.
Yeah. So is that, how much of that is the dominant, does that just stem from the parents, you know, and the dominant parent? Because you just said that one parent is more dominant than the other. And I think that's a natural thing in a relationship. And we all know who the dominant one is. the minute we hear that, we all know if it's the mom or the dad.
Yeah.
It makes sense to me when you're talking about it that it would have such an impact on those beliefs about ourselves. Is absolutely that
right? And you know, the ego states, and anyone that's, you know, really interested in reading up on this, Richard Swartz is the originator of internal family systems theory, but also Janina Fisher wrote about it, a wonderful book, Healing the Fragmented Selves of Trauma Survivors.
Okay.
But how do these ego states actually emerge? The theories from Vanderhart and others would say that when there are points in your life when you feel, you know, very frightened or very unsure, and there are parts of you that can be frozen in time. So the 8-year-old that failed her spelling and test and the 12-year-old that didn't get into the play, there might be parts of them that are still with you and urging you not to take courageous decisions. So ego state work can work with the fragmented parts of self, which can be earlier parts of you, or it could just be attachment figures or early influences.
Okay, on you. May not necessarily be the parents. Yeah.
But often when you allow yourself to explore someone's emotional map and you do the parts type work, it's quite explorative and curious work. And everyone is so special and unique that it's really hard to make generic sweeping comments. And when somebody privileges you with the most intimate parts of their life, they let you into their internal dialogue, really interesting things can unfold. And once they become aware of that conversation that's happening, it really strengthens your level of control, your level of self-awareness. And you can map back where the fear is coming from or where the uncertainty is coming from. And ultimately, it leads to a more integrated, powerful self.
And understanding of the self.
Yes.
So another thing I wanted to talk about, which is in your toolkit, I know. And I say toolkit in my inverted commas. So EMDR. Now, I didn't know what EMDR was until I have never heard of it until I started following you. And I know we kind of briefly touched on it, but I wanted to kind of keep the explanation and the chat about EMDR for the podcast. So you're going completely into, you're explaining EMDR to aliens, because I surely don't know what it is.
Legal aliens, hopefully.
For people who really have no idea, can you explain to me what it is and how you use it as a tool?
Yeah, of course. So EMDR stands for eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing.
Okay.
EMDR for short. It was invented by Francine Shapiro, who actually unfortunately passed away this year.
Okay.
She was the originator and it was invented in the 80s. And I might actually just give a little bit about the story of how she happened upon it.
Yeah.
Because she was in NYU and she was an English literature PhD candidate, and she had everything done except for her dissertation when she learned that she had cancer. And she was very, very upset and she went into the woods. And she noticed that she had this unique ability to move her eyes left and right, reminiscent of rapid eye movement in your sleep. And as she went into the woods and she looked at, you know, the flora and the wildlife, she noticed that it brought down all of what we call cognitive hyperarousal, which is the racing cyclical thoughts and the physiological response. And she noticed that it was comforting to her. So she piloted
comforting to her to move her eyes from side to side.
Yes.
For to be simple, is that what,
And you know, don't try this at home. Okay. You can't do it on your own.
Okay. The minute you said it, I was gonna try it.
No, no.
I'm like.
So she began. Looking around the room. She began very intense research on this, and it's an 8-pronged protocol of phases. And the first stage of EMDR is history taking. So you're mapping, you're learning about those negative schemas and those unmetabolized memories, which is, you know, a little bit like a skipping disc. You keep replaying the most painful part of the memory, like it might be an intrusive thought, a nightmare, panic attack, or just the sense of shame. And with that, you actually begin to work with the client in terms of affect regulation, which is relaxing, calming techniques with the body. And from there, you actually begin to identify a memory that you would like to reprocess and desensitize yourself to.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're following the protocol of EMDR, you are using bilateral stimulation, and that stimulates the left and right hemispheres of the brain. And when you're using bilateral stimulation, it calms the central nervous system and opens up the lateral thinking. So before, when you'd visit the memory, you'd be like, oh, it's too painful, I gotta suppress it, I gotta numb out, mm-hmm. I don't want to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually able to go a little bit deeper.
Yeah.
And that skipping disc, which is reminiscent of the painful, unmetabolized memory, it now can rotate and the memory can be metabolized. And that's known as adaptive information processing.
Okay, so you're saying that basically the eye movement, the direction of the eye movement, you, as a human, you can do that. Like, the direction of the eye movement is helping your brain to process, like, each side of the brain?
Yes, okay, so you cannot do it on your own.
Okay.
It's guided by fingers, or what's known as a therapulse, which
okay.
is, it vibrates palm to palm, or it can be done with a light.
Okay, so it has to be guided.
Yeah. So anyone that's doing it now that's listening, please stop.
Right.
Because you can't do it.
Right. You know, when you're younger and you say, if the wind
yeah.
blows, you'll get stuck that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, exactly. But basically, the bilateral stimulation, it's calming the central nervous system, kind of like rapid eye movement in your sleep.
Okay.
And when you have rapid eye movement in your sleep, you're also organizing your thoughts.
Do we do that in our sleep just naturally?
Yes, we
okay.
do. Yeah, at certain phases of the sleep, you're doing rapid eye movement.
Okay.
In very deep sleeps.
Okay.
And when you're doing this while you're metabolizing a memory, processing a memory, desensitizing yourself, you're actually adaptively processing that painful memory.
Mm-hmm.
And the analogy that's often used for EMDR, and this is going to be a little bit, I guess it's going to be a bit disgusting, but I'm going to go with it anyway. When you have a foreign object under the skin and it's festering, no healing can occur until that object is taken out.
Yeah.
And it might be a little bit painful when you take it out, but healing can finally emerge.
Yeah.
And unmetabolized memories are the skipping disc. It feels a little bit like that. It feels like there's a memory that's causing a lot of pain throughout the body.
Yeah.
And it's very hard for healing to occur until that memory is metabolized.
Yeah.
And you're desensitized.
Yeah.
And then you can begin to reevaluate how you view yourself and how
mm-hmm.
you view the world.
Mm-hmm.
Do you now view the world as a safe place?
Mm-hmm.
Do you realize that it was not your fault? Do you know that you're good enough? You know, it's very individualistic, so it's really hard to make generalizations.
Yeah.
But the unmetabolized memory is like that foreign object.
Yeah. So an example of a memory, say, from childhood would be maybe one parent might have left at some point, and obviously you feel there's a lot of questions why somebody would leave, and you know there's a lot of love there, and you know it's confusion, or I'm putting words on it that may not necessarily be associated with it, but just for the sake of having an example, when people don't deal with that and they might have trauma symptoms,
yeah,
the EMDR helps when what you were saying earlier, metabolize that memory, meaning
yeah.
by metabolize meaning go back to the memory,
yes,
work through it almost,
yeah,
and you know figure it out so that it brings it to the surface, and that's where the healing occurs once it's brought up and metabolized and dealt with.
Well, I'm very impressed.
Yeah, I
picked up
I'm
so
trying
much.
To, I'm basically repeating what you said,
yeah,
but I hope
no,
that I've got it.
I can tell that you're really interested in this.
Yeah,
the example that you chose,
yeah,
of see, the thing about kids is
mm.
they have so little control over the world
mm-hmm.
that they adopt a moral defense.
Mm.
And what that means is they take responsibility for things that were not their fault.
Yeah.
So when a parent leaves, or if they're abused, they have a tendency to blame themselves.
Yeah.
You know, this parent left because I'm not lovable,
mm-hmm.
for example. And, you know, the thing about attachment-based memories, they're the deepest rooted and the most painful traumatic experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not just a random one-off event.
Mm-hmm.
It feels deeply, deeply personal.
Mm-hmm.
So they take a little bit longer to work through. And for my clients, I like to start with a memory with a lower charge,
mm-hmm.
so that they can have a sense of mastery. It's mm-hmm. kind of like, you know, you would map out your course. Like you, when you first moved to New York, the first yeah. time you got in a subway, you were like, oh my God, what is going on?
Mm-hmm.
And now you can zip around and have dual awareness. Your mind is somewhere else. You're barely present.
Mm. Dual awareness. That's me all over.
Yeah.
Away with the berries.
So for the first memory, I like to do something that feels a little bit more manageable.
Mm-hmm.
But then when the client is ready and they feel comfortable,
yeah.
we can go deeper. And those early memories are, you know, they're deeply, deeply rooted in terms of the person's idea of who they are and the world around them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of a very painful memory that I have worked on with clients, but it takes a little bit of time.
Yeah. Because
it's very, very painful, and it's deeply personal to the perception they have of themselves.
Right. When is EMDR not necessary or not helpful?
Okay, that's a really good question. And there's a couple of different areas. It's not helpful if you're actively abusing drugs or mm-hmm. binge drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason being is it can break down, you know, the walls of defense.
Yeah.
And it's also not helpful if there's active suicidal ideation
mm-hmm.
or active, you know, self-harming behaviors. You can do the beginning parts. You can do the, you know, the somatic calming exercises, and you can do the history taking, and you can identify schemas. But the actual reprocessing itself, if the client is in some way vulnerable, it's not. It would be too high risk.
Okay.
So the client has to be ready, and part of the first two stages of EMDR is identifying a sense of readiness.
Mm-hmm.
And no healing from trauma can take place until a person feels safe in their body. So the exercises that you do for containment strategies and all the tools that you teach at the beginning,
yeah.
they're really, really important in assessing if a client is ready for EMDR.
Okay.
Because you have this duty of care for a client where you cannot cause more harm than good.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the dignity of risk, and that's that you will allow them to venture into painful areas if they feel comfortable.
Yeah.
But with EMDR, when you're assessing for readiness, you're being very, very mindful of particular red flags, which may indicate to you that a client cannot tolerate EMDR. And that doesn't mean that the door is closed to them indefinitely.
Mm.
It just means that at this particular point in their lives, they need a little bit more stabilization and skill building so that you can work towards it as a long-term goal.
Okay, got it. You talked about the rapid eye movement.
Yeah.
And in your sleep, how is there a connection between nightmares, ongoing nightmares, and the fact that you're with the rapid eye movement, you're accessing that part of your brain that are deep memories that haven't been metabolized?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, again, going back to the analogy that I used of the skipping disc.
Yeah.
When you're in your fight or flight response,
mm-hmm.
or let's say you're frozen, you're outside of your window of tolerance,
mm-hmm.
and the memory becomes perfectly preserved, like the negativity bias, to keep you safe.
Yeah.
But when you go into the memory, there's an avoidance or numbing. It cuts off at the most distressing point. So it keeps coming up intrusively, but then it cuts off at the most distressing point. And the skipping disc type movement in the memory, it can actually happen in dreams.
Okay.
So the nightmares, night terrors are a symptom of PTSD, as is avoidance and numbing.
Mm.
And the interesting thing is that the avoidance and numbing perpetuates the skipping disc. So in order to make it a more comfortable experience, EMDR is reducing the distressing elements of the memory, both physiologically and emotionally, so that you can begin to complete the sequence.
Okay.
So
the when you say complete the sequence, you mean the disc isn't skipping anymore?
Well, you're allowed to fully go into the memory and complete the memory, because the more avoidance and numbing perpetuates the fear and it becomes quite, you know, phobic.
Yeah, okay, got it. All right, well, I can't believe the time is adding up as it is. I wanted to ask you maybe some, because we didn't really talk about it at the start, but maybe some advice that you might have to budding psychotherapists. And this can be whatever you feel like, as deep or as general as you want, because I know that a lot of people are interested in your area of study.
Absolutely. Okay, so the best advice I can say, and I've been really fortunate to have clients from all over the world,
mm-hmm.
is be curious.
Mm.
Allow your client to reveal their reality and their world through to you through their eyes, and don't make assumptions.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the most important things that people want to be seen, they want to be heard, and they want to be witnessed. And if you can witness their pain in a compassionate way and actively listen and create a sense of respect for them, that one area of their life will blossom into all other areas, and it will change their life. So your ability to be non-judgmental, to be curious, and, you know, when you're curious and when you're open, you can feel it in your energy, you can see it in your face, you can hear it in your language. So you really, really have to feel that to the very core.
Mm.
And if you feel like you have what us therapists call countertransference, which is when the, let's just say, for example, a therapist has a client that reminds her of her first class teacher.
Yeah.
And she has all of this latent feelings of judgment or emotion. And when you have some countertransference, the client will sense that in your words, in your face, and in the way you connect. So you have to be very nurturing and neutral in the space, so that you're creating a space for the client that is safe, that is completely somewhere where, unlike other areas of their life where they have to wear a mask and they have to perform in a certain way, it's a completely neutral frame where they can be completely vulnerable and open and know that you'll have unconditional positive regard.
Okay, that has sparked another question for me. People who are attending therapy and don't feel the benefit of it, do you believe that there has to be a right match with your therapist?
Absolutely. So there's several different factors to take into account in terms of finding the right therapist.
Mm-hmm.
First off, credentials and education and training aside, when you put two people in the room, personality will show.
Mm.
And you're either going to feel comfortable privileging someone with the most intimate areas of your life,
mm-hmm.
or it's just not going to feel comfortable for you.
Mm-hmm.
You also want to feel like the therapist is actively hearing you and remembering important details. Not every session should feel like your first session.
Mm.
If you feel like it's a comfortable, safe place, but you've stagnated, you're no longer getting anything from it, and your needs are not being met, that is also another indicator that the therapy is not serving you. The time and the money that you're investing is not fulfilling the intended purpose. And through your own level of discernment, you should look elsewhere. And also, you know, if you feel like there's an element of, when you are about to go into therapy or after therapy, you're feeling, your body is telling you you feel uncomfortable, or there's something about the person that is aggravating an old wound, you should be mindful of that and honor, you know, your own sense of the person.
Okay, and that it's not a match.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, last but not least, is there any books that you might recommend, or any, not authors, but doctors or anything that you would recommend for people who are curious to learn more about trauma in their, you know, personal time?
Absolutely. So I guess the trauma Bible really is Bessel van der Kolk, The Body Keeps the Score.
Okay.
Really amazing book. And also the whole book is transcribed for free on YouTube, but it does take 8 hours to listen to.
Okay.
So if you have if you're curious.
That's an 8 hour podcast.
If you have 8 hours and you're curious, Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score.
Very interesting title.
Obviously, I have to plug Francine Shapiro.
Okay. That's the creator of EMDR.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Who unfortunately did pass away earlier
this
year.
Yes, and that one's Getting Past Your Past.
Yes, and then Janina Fisher. If you're interested in ego state therapy, the originator is Richard Swartz. But there is a really fascinating book, Healing the Fragmented Selves of the Trauma Survivor, which is actually applicable to everyone. And mm-hmm. it could be, you know, very interesting reading. But in terms of, you know, if you just want to get to know more, I would definitely, you know, privilege or prioritize Bessel van der Kolk.
Okay, got it. And for anybody who's listening, we will pop the names of the titles in the description box as well. Well, Gillian, thank you so much for coming on and spending your time here. And it's late, it's a Wednesday night, and we're all tired, but I appreciate it. And hopefully your words have kind of opened the door. Something we talked about earlier, just kind of the stigma with therapy, especially in Ireland. Unfortunately, we're getting better, but kind of opening the door and making people more aware of what's available to them.
Thank you. And I hope that you continue to create a dialogue and a conversation in Ireland about prioritizing your mental health and taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
And taking care of your self-care. And I really admire everything that you're doing.
Oh, well, vice versa. Thank you.